tonight we're talking about the value of freedom. This is really two questions. I don't know if I'll get to both of them tonight. One question is, how valuable is freedom? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Whatever you say. Can't be tomorrow. It must be Wednesday night, huh? Okay. Go on, my portable brain. Tonight is friendship, eh? I have something pretty bitter to say about friendship. The trouble is not only bitter, but it's realistic. There are two types of friends. There are friendships that are based on sharing certain activities. Sharing activities that both people enjoy. There's some friends that you would go bowling with, but you would never dream of having a political discussion with them. See? Look at that. Struck a chord right away. Right? And some people who you'd have a political discussion with, but you'd never share with them or discuss your plans for your future. Most people enjoy the company of other people while they're doing things. They don't like to be alone a lot of the time. It's nice to have people you can share your activities with. Go bicycling, paint the living room. Nice to do it together with friends. Because people are different, they like different activities. Friendships based on shared activities. What happens if a person's life changes? Life changes, and there's a pretty big shift in the kind of activities that he used to enjoy. All of a sudden, he will discover that a great number of his friendships just disappear. Because those friendships were based on sharing those activities. Once you don't do those activities anymore, you find out that, you know, you just don't have anything in common and the friendships last. But it's not a terrible tragedy because you move to different activities. In the new activities, you'll find other people who are doing those things and with whom you'll be able to share doing those new things. This is what happens when people become frum. So, the discotheque friends and the drinking friends and all the other things. You're not going to go to discotheques. You're not going to drink. You're not going to watch movies. There's just nothing left. So you know, you go your way, and I'll go my way. We have no connection anymore. Because the whole friendship was based on those activities that you both enjoyed doing. And now that one has changed, friendship just disappears. That's 99.6% of all friendships. I don't know. Is it 0.6 exact? Could be 0.7. I don't know. Then, at least in theory, there's another kind of friendship where you have a relationship with another person and you're committed to that person because of who the person is, not because of the things he likes to do. You feel a connection with that person. And even if your activities would change, his activities would change and end up not enjoying, involved in the same activities, still you would want to talk to one another, you would want to share with one another, you would want to compare notes with one another, you want to have time just to renew your connection with one another. That's a person-to-person friendship, not a friendship based on activities. The word for friend in Hebrew is chaver. What does that word mean? It's a root. Lechaber means to join things together. To join things together. Chaver means to are connected. They're inherently connected. Not that they're close to one another, you know, not far apart when they're doing something, but when they're doing something else, then they're really connected. The word in Hebrew seems to indicate the second type of friendship, even though that type of friendship is very, very rare. Now, I think we suffer from the fact that we don't have real friendships. Friendships of the second type. We have friendly acquaintances. Friendly acquaintances. But usually not more than that. There's a famous Hasidic parable, just two lines long. Two drunk Russian peasants are in the bar. And one says to the other, Igor, I love you. The other says, Dmitry, you do not love me. Igor, I love you. Dmitry, you do not love me. Well, the six is four, seven more changes. Who's talking to who? Dmitry says to Igor, why? Why do you say I don't love you? He says, if you loved me, you would know what hurts me. If you loved me, you would know what hurts me. But you see, you can play tennis with somebody, you can talk politics with the next guy, you can discuss current events with the next guy, you can go bicycling with the next guy, and have no idea what hurts them. It doesn't even come up. We're playing tennis, that's all. If you hit good shots, I'll congratulate you. If you hit lousy shots, I'll commiserate with you. That's it. I don't want anything else about you. I don't, you know, because you're my tennis friend, and you're my politics friend, and you're my house painting friend. That's it. No, if you really had a connection, you would know. You would feel. You'd share that with the other person. Now I want to talk a little bit about what the second type of friendship means. And we'll talk about some obstacles. If I'm connected to somebody, a chaver, chibur, there's a connection. So what happens to him, I feel, is also happening to me. What happens to me is happening to him. That's why I know what pains him. I know what pains him because I feel for him. I don't only feel for myself, I feel for him also. Maybe you've had this experience. If you haven't, when you become parents, you definitely will. Some child you love is in a performance. Let's say your six-year-old brother is sitting there in the audience. And he gets up on the stage, comes his time to say his lines, and he forgets. He's standing there, open mouth, nothing goes out, right? How do you feel? You feel awful, awful. Your stomach plunges to your shoes, you know, and you just feel awful. You feel worse than he does. He probably doesn't realize what a great tradition he's happening. You know, he'll never get a shidduch, you know, it's hopeless. Because he's up there on the stage, you're up there on the stage with him. Because there's this connection between you and him. If there's another kid, you might feel mildly, you know, sympathetic, but you don't feel the same way at all. Because there isn't that connection with some other kid, but your family, someone you care about, someone with whom you identify, not because of shared activities, you identify with the person as a person. Now, what would I want for my friend? What would I want to do for my friend? What kind of interactions do I think of for a friend like this where there's a real connection, where I feel his feelings, where I know what hurts him. Let's suppose my friend comes and asks me for a glass of gin after his third glass of gin. He's my friend and he's asking me for a favor. What do I do? Well, if I am in pain over what hurts him and I know that he can injure himself, I don't give him the glass of gin. Because I want what's good for him. So I don't give him everything he asks for. I want what's good for him. And here you have this self-serving, lazy, evil liberal who says, who am I to dictate to someone else what he should do? Every person is free to make his own choices. It's very paternalistic of me to think that I know better than he what's good for him, and all the rest of that can't. And after his third glass of gin, I know what's good for him. What's good for him is to stop. And it's certainly not good for him than for me to help him drink more. And then I have a responsibility for him. Liberal Kant is often just an excuse for irresponsibility. I don't want to take responsibility for somebody else. So I go my way and he goes his way. He's a drunk and I'm not. Too bad for him, is the unspoken message, which is cruel and irresponsible. So I want what's good for him. Which may mean, at times, denying what he asks for, what he desires, in favor of what's really good for him. Now, if anybody still has any illusions about whether they have these kinds of friendships, I want to apply this to something that's extremely practical, and which is never done at all. At least I've never heard of anybody doing it. You've probably had this experience a number of times. You look at somebody doing something and you say, that poor fellow, if he only knew how bad he looks, he would never do that. If he only knew how bad he looks, he would never do that. And you're right. If he knew, he wouldn't do it. So why does he do it? Because he doesn't know how bad it looks. That's why he does it. And why doesn't he know how bad it looks? Because no one will tell him. No one will tell him. Including his friends won't tell him how bad it looks. No, we have relationships of mutual flattery. All we tell each other is how good we look. All we tell each other is how successful we think the other guy is. All we do is give the other guy compliments. Why? Who am I to criticize, says the liberal. Or, it's very unpleasant, you know. I'll come across as holier than thou. I don't want to come across like that. You know, I'm not perfect, so why should I go tell him about his mistakes and faults? We have every excuse in the book. What's the answer? What's the result? The result is that we don't tell the other person how bad he looks. And he continues to look bad. He continues to shoot himself in the foot over and over again because we won't tell him. But now, suppose your friend is riding a bicycle. You notice that he's got a nail in one tire and the air's going out. And he's riding quite fast. And as the air goes out, he's going to be endangered. Wouldn't you stop him? He said, listen, hey, nail in the tire, get off, stop, quick. Of course, you don't want your friend to be injured. But now his behavior is going to cost him his job. His behavior is going to cost him his relationship with his child. Or with his wife. Or it's going to cost him his respect in the community. That's not going to hurt him. It's going to hurt him. So why don't we yell at him, you've a nail in the tire, you're hurting yourself. No, we don't do that. We don't do that. Because. Meanwhile, the guy's going down the drain, and we're not helping him. We're not stopping him. About 100 years ago in Europe, certain yeshivas they had the following practice. They had groups of talmidim, let's say about 8. Every week they would get together. 7 would write out their observations of the 8. What do you look like to me? If I remember correctly, they didn't sign them. But the 7 wrote out how the 8 one looks to them. And then they would gather them together and they would read them together with the eighth guy. So he would have an honest feedback, an honest picture. This is how you look to us, we who love you, we who care about you. This is how you look to us. Isn't that immensely valuable? Why don't we do it? Because we don't have that kind of friendship. We don't have that kind of friendship. Where we really care about the other person's good. Where we really care what happens to them. Even in marriages, you often don't have it. Afraid of upsetting the relationship and so forth and so on. And the result of it is, the person who knows you best and the person who cares most about you can't express the things to you that would be of such immense value. That's a tragedy. Friendship, this real friendship, is based on what is really good for the person. And what's really good for the person is this kind of feedback, which is absolutely crucial. This caring for the other person's needs has different levels. And for this, you've got to be quite thoughtful. In Shemoneh Esrei, at the end of the first bracha, we say, Melech Ozer Umoshia Umagen. The king who helps, saves, and protects. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all three all the time. But these three for different parts of your life. Sometimes he helps. Helps means I have to do it. I have to do it. But I don't have to do it alone. He won't abandon me. He'll help me. We'll do it together. Saves means I can't do it. I just can't handle it. It's beyond me. I don't know where to get started. So, he saves me from it. Protects means it doesn't even get to me. That's what it says, shield. It doesn't even get to me. I don't even get into trouble in the first place. Now, some things I have to do. I'm put here to do. I'm not put here just to coast my whole life. So there's some things I have to do, but he helps me. The other things which are really beyond my ability, so he saves me. The other things that he protects me from. In a friendship, we also have to ask ourselves, insofar as we have the power, in what things does my friend need help? In what things does my friend need to be saved? And if I can, I should save him. From what things does my friend need to be protected? And if I can protect him, I will protect him. For example, let's suppose there's a family problem. You know that you have a friend, and you know the family, the parents, the siblings, whoever it is that the problem involves. And you might be able to solve it. You might be able to solve it. That is to say, to save your friend from the problem. But it might not be right. It might be that he needs to work through this problem. Because you're not always going to be there. And he needs to grow to the point where he can handle these problems on his own. So you say, yes, I could save him, but it's wrong to save him. But that's not what he really needs. He needs my help in working him through it on his own. So you have to be very careful and think, what is really good for my friend? What is really good for him? And make a distinction between these three different levels of interacting. Just as a Kadosh Baruch Hu does to us. One help, this is crucial for everything. When you look at your friend, you look at yourself, you look at how you're interacting, and you look at what his possibilities are, what his problems are, you have to try, I know this is hard, but you have to try to look at it from a Kadosh Baruch Hu's point of view. You have to try to see it through Kadosh Baruch Hu's eyes. What does he want? What does he want? How does he evaluate the situation? Here's an illustration of the difference between our point of view and his point of view. I decided to try to be more hospitable. Friday night, I look around shul, I look for people who are strangers, and I invite them to come to me. for Shabbos, for a meal. One Friday night, I'm sitting there, Baruch Hu. I sit down, look around, there he is, right over there, next to the last row on the right hand side. Ah, my guest. Okay, just wait for Elena, and I'm, you know, he's my meat. So, Elena Shabbat, you know, Vanachto, the Kaddish, and I'm off. And who do I see? Reuven. Reuven is 3 steps ahead of me. He's 3 steps ahead of me! Gets to the guy first. Hello, who are you? Out of town? Need a place for Shabbos? Yes? Bang! He goes off with Reuven! How do I feel? Terrible! He was my guest! My mitzvah of hospitality! Look what happened! Now ask yourself, how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu feel? Is there any loss in this scenario from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's point of view at all? The stranger got his invitation. And Reuven did a mitzvah. And I wanted to do the mitzvah, so I get credit also. I also get credit for doing the mitzvah. Because I was stopped by circumstances out of my control. So one did the mitzvah, and the second one gets credit for the mitzvah. I don't think, because from his point of view, there's any loss here at all. So why do I feel bad? I feel bad because I'm not looking at it from his point of view. Well, that's a mistake. I ought to be looking at it from his point of view. So the first thing in any situation, and this certainly includes friendship, first thing is to ask yourself, what does the Kodesh Baruch Hu want? And then to help him see that. This is probably more important than anything else. Expand a little bit. What kinds of things can you give to a friend? What kind of things that will help can you give to a friend? Money? Support, psychological support, advice, training, information, all of that side. Also the truth. The truth is side. Especially important truths. Like, what am I in the world for? What are my real alternatives, opportunities? What are the consequences of a decision this way or that way? And especially from Kodesh Baruch Hu's point of view, there's a tremendous gift of perspective. Giving the person perspective. How to evaluate what he's doing, where he is, what his chances are. This is also a gift. Gift doesn't have to be dollars. Indeed, wisdom. Wisdom is more important than dollars. Sometimes the wisdom enables you to make dollars. And other types of wisdom enable you to live in the way that dollars can't buy. So if you have a piece of wisdom, that may be the most important thing you can share with your friend. Eyes, does it come off as superior if you're sharing your wisdom with him? No, because if you're smart, you'll ask him to share his wisdom with you also. Because everybody's experiences are different. Everybody's interactions are different. Everybody's come across inspiring people who picked it up. You share that with somebody else, you share it with them something very precious. So, when you're looking to do for your friend what he really needs, think in terms of the really important things in your life. What do you care about? What's important to you? And then realize that people are similar, especially if they come from reasonably similar backgrounds, and what's important to you might be important to him as well. And don't spend the friendship on bowling. I didn't say don't go bowling. I didn't say go bowling. I just said, don't spend the friendship on bowling. Very often, people who need to make a decision, don't see clearly what the decision is about. How do I handle problems with my family? They don't see what the stakes are. They don't see what the consequences are. I've had Bali Tshuva who handled their relationship with their parents so badly that the parents didn't come to their wedding. That's tragic. It's tragic for the parents and it's tragic for the children. It sets up a barrier that's very difficult to break down with. But the child says, all my friends are in Jerusalem, so the wedding has to be in Jerusalem. Forgetting that the people who birthed you and raised you and invested in you for 20 years, and their friends are all in New York, and you also want them to pay for it, and you're telling them that they have to come to a bunch of strangers for the wedding of their child. That's not pushing. That's not, you know, that's not obvious. So what are the stakes here? In addition to keeping up, honoring one's parents. Okay, now, there are barriers here. There are barriers to making these kinds of friendships. Some of them are philosophical, some of them are psychological. I'll run through a few just to hopefully take off the barriers so that you don't get caught by them. I ask you to open this window. Someone over there, open that window. It's going to be very well. Having a friendship like this is a little bit like marriage. It really is. I cast my lot with the other person. What pains him pains me. I care about what's happening with him. If he goes through one of those embarrassing experiences, I'm going to feel terrible. Won't this mean a loss of independence? Won't this create dependence? Even, maybe, God forbid, codependency? isn't that a big price to pay? I mean, isn't that a terrible thing that a person... Now, I think here we're in the grips of a terrible, destructive illusion. Western experience and the language is shot through with an illusion that detaches you from reality. We tell a child, stand on your own two feet! Make it on your own! Be independent! We talk about, with great praise, we talk about the self-made man. I always want to ask one of these guys, did you sew your own clothes? Did you build your own automobile? Make your own pencils? Did you ever borrow money from the bank? Self-made man, eh? Did it all by yourself. I mean, who's kidding whom? Not only that, but, you know, somebody taught you how to read, how to write, how to, you know, taught you the information that you got you through school. So where does it come from, the idea of the self-made man? Because if I do it on my own, without help from others, that's better. It's more my achievement. I can take more credit for it, and so on and so on. This is a terrible mistake. Nobody makes it alone. Nobody. There's no significant achievement that is accomplished alone. Especially today with the internet. Because the internet, you're exchanging information with people all over the world all the time. You can be a mathematician or a poet, or it makes absolutely no difference. But more than that, everybody needs someone who believes in him. Someone who values him. Someone who trusts him. Someone who can appreciate it. Without that kind of support, the motivation just ebbs away. The motivation just seeps away. So, are you really doing it alone? No, you're not doing it alone. The idea of doing it alone is an illusion. But the destructiveness in the illusion is this. Because you really are depending on others, and you think you aren't, then you don't appreciate them enough. You don't reinforce them enough, and you don't get as much support as you could get. You don't have as much support as you could have. And you don't give as much support to the others as you could give. So we're lacking in this crucial cement that holds us up. This is a new phenomenon. It wasn't always like this. Aristotle writes that man is by his very nature social. A human being, by his nature, is defined by his interactions with other people. The idea of a disconnected individual is a nonsense idea. But we're stuck with this image. So this image is blinding us to the reality. I have a friend in Houston He does counseling. He's a psychologist. He was doing marriage counseling for a psychiatrist. This psychiatrist, marriage counseling, or what they call relationship counseling now, the psychiatrist had been through 5 relationships in 2 years. And in all 5 cases, the women walked out. This guy is wealthy. Psychiatrist means that he's empty and straight in psychology as well. Plenty of brains. What went wrong? So the psychologist friend of mine told me, it's very simple. He has such a fear of being dependent that whenever he goes into a relationship with a woman, he makes sure that he's giving to her all the time. He smothers her in gifts. Money, time, effort, concern, counseling. He's always giving to her. Well, after a while, she feels like a fifth wheel, you know? She feels like she's worthless. No one wants to stay in a relationship where you feel you're worthless. So they all walked out on him. And he, psychiatrist, couldn't figure it out. So they had to come to the psychologist for counseling. You know, what's going wrong? So my mother-in-law would say, Klieg, it's a failed seichel. Very smart, but no seichel. no plain common sense to see. Stand heading on the board. So, this myth of independence holds people back from getting into relationships like this, because in these relationships you will come to depend on the other person, the other person will depend upon you. Now, I am told that there's such a thing as a condition called codependency. Codependency is terrible because each person in these codependent relationships can't function without the other. Can't function. Their whole identity is tied up with the other. And if they lose the relationship, then they're devastated. They go to pieces. And that's a sickness. Okay. Maybe so. Maybe carried to that extreme could be a sickness. You know, if you drink too much water, you'll drown. Water can kill you. But I wouldn't recommend cutting out water. That's probably not good for your health. So let's say that codependency carried to that extent where the loss of the other person means you go to pieces. Is that appropriate? But what about, I won't call it codependency, that's the code name for the disease, mutual dependency, to the point where if you lose a relationship, it's going to hurt bad. And you're going to spend a period of time disoriented. And it's going to be hard to recover. How about that? Should we protect ourselves against that? In order to protect ourselves against that pain when the relationship is lost? Listen, guys, if you have anything precious, anything, if you lose it, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. And if it's really precious and it's integrated into your life, then losing it means you're going to be disoriented for a while. That's what it means to have something precious. Is the right move to make sure you don't have anything precious? Is that the right move? I don't think so. Because that's killing your life with your own two hands. Going through life without anything precious? I was in Chicago a number of years ago. Two women in their 30s approached me about shidduchim. I think because I travel a lot. You know, I have a whole raft of population up my sleeve. I asked them about themselves. And one thing they told me was, listen, Rabbi, we're prepared for marriage. Oh? Yes, we're prepared. We have our own private bank accounts that will not be made into joint property. And we're both professionally qualified. And we're ready. When divorce comes, we're ready to be able to support ourselves. We're prepared for marriage. Prepared for marriage means prepared for the divorce so that you won't be dependent when the divorce comes. I couldn't say anything, but they were so happy about it. They were so proud of it. But I was devastated. That's how you prepare for marriage, by preparing for the divorce. So how do you go in? How do you feel? How do you commit yourself to the other person? Yeah, you commit yourself to the other person, making sure that you're all ready to leave. This is a terrible, terrible self-defeating attitude that people have, this attitude of needing to be independent. There's another problem, more philosophical, but still, I guess, worth mentioning. What is it that my life means? What is it that my life does? What is it that my life accomplishes? Here's a picture that I think many people have. Either they've thought of it this way or it's sort of implicit in the way they think about things. Imagine the history of the world. The history of the world as it actually goes. With me in it. Now, imagine just subtracting me. Just subtract me from the history. So, you know, instead of my birth, there was a miscarriage or something, right? And I'm out. Okay, so then other things aren't there. Like, my children aren't there. And the books I wrote aren't there. And classes that I taught aren't there. And, you know, the world is different in the picture where I'm, in the history that I'm not in, right? Now, compare the two histories and subtract. Subtract the one where I'm not there from the one where I am there. That's me. What's left over is me. It's what I did. What I accomplished. It's the difference I made to the world. The things that happened in the world because I was there. That's my life. That's what I did. That's what I accomplished. That's what it means. I think it's a very natural picture. And it's dead wrong. It's dead wrong. That's not the way to appreciate what a life is. I'll give you an example. I don't know how you feel about democracy, but if you aren't in favor of it, pretend you are. Okay? Favor of democracy. Democracy is very important. People who believe in democracy believe that in an election, people should vote. Other things being equal, everybody should vote. Okay, so now I say, why should I vote? After all, my vote isn't going to make any difference at all. My one vote isn't going to change this election. It's not even going to change the political commentators. The Jews on the west side of town voted this way, and the Catholics on the east side of town voted that way, so the balance of power is swinging this way and that way. My one vote isn't going to even affect that. Certainly in a national election where it's decided by hundreds of thousands of votes, at least millions of votes, my one vote isn't going to make any difference at all. So why should I vote? If you have this picture of history with me in it and history with me out of it, and you're subtracting, so that afternoon where I spent an hour going to the polls and standing in line and then pulling down the levers, if you're in a modern country, or putting in the paper ballots if you live in Israel, and walking out, that hour makes no difference. The world goes on exactly the way it went on before. Okay, you can make up cases. I'm the editor of a newspaper, and I write editorials and so on and so on. Yeah, I could write the editorials and still my vote. Right? My one vote isn't going to make any difference. So why should I vote? So you think I have an obligation to vote, and to pay my taxes, and to pay bus fare on the bus. And any of these cases where you have a lot of people acting together to accomplish a joint result, where the contribution of the individual is negligible. It's so small it won't make any difference to the outcome. Why should the person do it? Now this is a well-discussed problem in philosophy. You can debate it among yourselves if you like. It's a cute problem. By the way, the answer that leaps to most people's minds, but look, if everybody did that, the system would collapse. That's true, but irrelevant. So what? I'm not everybody. I'm only me. My one vote is still my one vote. Yeah, if everybody decides to do that, it'll collapse. But listen, if everybody decides to do it, and I'm the only one who goes to the polls, it'll still collapse. I can't stop it either way. And if 62.7% decide to go to the polls, it'll still be 62.7% whether I go or I don't go. So whether it collapses or it doesn't collapse, gets weaker, it gets stronger, has nothing to do with my one vote. So what do I care about what will happen if everybody? I'm not responsible for everybody. That's surely correct. The answer that's given which I think is correct, is this. True, my action doesn't make a difference to the outcome. But, if I believe in democracy, then I believe, that's if, right? Don't quote me. Or quote me with the if. If I believe in democracy, then I believe that the democracy is delivering a benefit. It's delivering a benefit to the society as a whole, including me. I'm getting a benefit out of this scheme. It's unfair. It's unfair to get a benefit and not pay your dues. It's unfair to get a benefit and not pay your dues. You're getting something for nothing where the nothing is not right. And therefore, it's wrong for me not to vote. But this means I have to think of myself in different terms now. I'm not an individual acting on my own and making a difference. I'm changing the world, and the way I change the world is my life, and that's what it means. That's not the right picture. I am an individual, and I am changing the world, but also a member of larger groups. And these larger groups do things together. And by doing them together, they create a benefit for the group as a whole, from which I benefit also. And because I'm a member of that group, I have certain responsibilities that have nothing to do with my changing the world. Here I have to think of myself in different terms. I can't think of myself as a disconnected individual. So think of myself as essentially part of a group. And because I'm part of that group, I have certain responsibilities. It changes what the meaning of my life is. Now, in Torah, there are very many ideas like this. Ideas where I am part of a group, and because I'm part of the group, it changes what I'm doing, it changes the meaning of what I'm doing, and it changes what my responsibilities are. Here's a classical example. Here's a halacha. Tell me what the halacha is. Friday night, I've made kiddush, made hamotzi, we ate the soup, there's a knock on the door. Open it up. The fellow is standing there and he says, you know, I haven't made kiddush, it's Friday night. Do me a favor. Make kiddush for me. Now you know how it works Friday night. Usually, the husband makes kiddush, everybody else listens, and that's how they satisfy their mitzvah of kiddush. They listen to him. So this guy says, make kiddush for me. So I say, you know, I wish I could help you out, but I did that already. I made kiddush an hour and a half ago. I mean, when I do the mitzvah of kiddush, you can listen, and you can be yotzei also. But I can't do the mitzvah of kiddush anymore, because I did it already. I could help you next Friday night, come back next Friday night, but my mitzvah of kiddush is sort of used up. So the Gemara says that I'm making a mistake. I can do it again. I can make kiddush again. Why? Because all Jews are responsible for one another. What's called arvus. All Jews are responsible for one another. Rashi's explanation. Trouble is, the explanation is not clear. I'm responsible for him? Okay, correct. I'm not just going to turn him away. I'll give him his own cup. I'll give him a sitter, and I'll help him that he should make it. So what if I'm responsible for him? I can help him in a lot of ways. You say he can't read Hebrew? I'll give him an English transliteration. Can't read at all? I'll say the words he can recite after me. I can help make kiddush in a lot of ways. I'm not turning him away. I'm not abandoning him. I'm taking responsibility for him. What's it got to do with the mitzvah of kiddush? The one thing I can't do for him, it seems to me, is say kiddush again, because if I say it, I'm only play-acting. I'm not doing the mitzvah of kiddush again. But the Ran, explaining Rashi, says yes. Because, says the Ran, if there's a Jew in the world, anywhere, who has to make kiddush, then my mitzvah of kiddush is still alive. My mitzvah of kiddush is still alive. It means I can make kiddush 5 times Friday night. And it's all my mitzvah. And since I'm doing my mitzvah, he can listen to me and satisfy his obligation. That's what the Ran says. And I think the idea in the Ran is this. To whom are the mitzvahs addressed? There's a good rule who say to each Jew, you make kiddush Friday night, and you make kiddush Friday night, and you make kiddush Friday night. That's not what happens. What the Baruch Hu says is, the Jewish people has to make Kiddush. The mitzvah is for the Jewish people as a whole. And each of you should do whatever you can to fulfill that mitzvah. The mitzvah is on the nation, not on the individual. The mitzvah is addressed socially. The mitzvah is addressed socially. And because I'm part of this society, part of this tzibur, that I have to extend myself to try to do the mitzvah. So here, if you understand the mitzvahs correctly, the mitzvahs bind us together as a group essentially, inherently, automatically. Because the mitzvahs aren't addressed to us as individuals. Similarly, from the other side of things, there's a punishment in the Torah, one of the worst punishments called kares. Kares means being cut off from Hashem. Now, this word appears more than 30 times in the Torah. Well, every time but one, it says you'll be cut off from the Jewish people. That's what it says. It means you'll be cut off from Hashem, but it says you'll be cut off from the Jewish people. What's the message? The message is, if you're cut off from the Jewish people, automatically, you're cut off from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because the way that you relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, largely, I wouldn't say 100%, but largely, is through other Jews, and through the Jewish people as a whole. So if you're cut off from the Jewish people, you're cut off. A good symptom of this is the following. You probably have heard that there are 248 positive mitzvos, which correspond to 248 something or others in the body. We call them limbs. I don't know if they're limbs or organs or something or other. And there are 365 negative commandments that correspond to 365 something or other else in the body, something or other, whatever they are. And each mitzvah serves, nourishes the corresponding part of the body. Well, this idea has a load of problems. One of which is, no Jew can do all 613 mitzvahs. It's just not possible. Because some are only for the king, and some are only for priests, and some are only for the high priest, and some are only for Levites, and some are only for men, and some are only for women. And there's just nobody who can do all 613. So if there are 613 mitzvahs and 613 parts of the body, and each one needs nourishment, how do you get it? Now, there are a lot of solutions to this problem. But one of them is this. That the Jewish people as a whole is connected. We're all connected to one another. And every time you do a mitzvah, you're creating a little spark of kedusha, of holiness, that's available to every other Jew. Imagine that we have a joint bloodstream. Now, you know that when your organs secrete hormones into the bloodstream, it goes throughout the whole bloodstream. Very quickly. They circulate the whole body. So when you put on tefillin, that tefillin, the kedusha created by that tefillin, becomes available to Jews everywhere. So let's say I'm not a Kohen, but there are Kohanim, and the Kohanim do those mitzvos, and those mitzvos create a kedusha that's available to everybody. You'll say that we haven't had Kohanim doing those mitzvos for 1800 years. That's true. But the Jewish people functions like a single body. And because we function like a single body, what's done at one time can be available at another time. I can tell you from my own experience and experience of others, if you do athletic training at your age, you'll be different at the age of 50 and at the age of 60 than otherwise you would have been. The fact that you stopped training for 30 years or 40 years, still, it makes a difference. It makes a difference in your strength, in your endurance, it makes a difference in your attitude. I went back to serious exercise almost 2 years ago because I did it when I was a student. It was very easy for me. For other people, it's unthinkable. And I saw where I started from and where other people started from. And it wasn't the same place. It wasn't the same place at all. So, it lasts, even though time goes on. Now, the Kohanim in the temple 2,000 years ago, who offered sacrifices, they created a certain reservoir of Kedusha, which is available to us later in time also. Which means that if you have your head screwed on right, when you do a mitzvah, you think, I'm a Jew. I'm a Jew connected to all other Jews. And I'm doing this mitzvah. And we, Hasidim and some Sephardim, have a formula that you say before you do a mitzvah. And it contains the phrase, B'shem Kol Yisrael. I'm doing this in the name of the whole Jewish people. In that way, I'm making my contribution to the Kedusha of the Jewish people as a whole. And I can then benefit from the contributions that other people have made, down through the ages, down through the millennia. What I'm illustrating for you is the idea of connectedness. Friendship is one aspect of connectedness. Connectedness is really the only way that human life can flourish. It can flourish, develop, flower into something fulfilled and beautiful. And we can start to build this in the friendships that we have. Now, dare I hope that you walk out of here friends and say to one another, let's try. Share with each other how we really look to one another. Think about what the other person needs. Try to feel the joys of the other person, the hurts of the other person, and not to be content with merely activity companions with whom we enjoy playing tennis or whatever, but nothing more than that. Friendship is good for the soul, and it's good for the development of the human being.
What was the philosophical block you're talking about? Yeah, I don't know if you said that.
Individualism.
So that was the first one.
Right.
Well, and you said you want to say a philosophical one afterwards.
Oh, no. The first one, fear of dependency.
Right.
That was the psychological one. And the philosophical one is individualism. What I am as an individual. I change the world by what I do. Subtract the histories. That's my whole life. But that was the philosophical block. Okay.
Was it okay that I turned it over?
Yeah.